Seven are they, seven are they. In the ocean deep, seven are they. They are reared in their home, the ocean deep. Neither male nor female are they. They are as the roaming wind blast. No wife have they, no son do they beget. They know neither mercy nor pity. They hearken not unto prayers and supplications. They are as the horses reared on the hills, the evil ones of E. Throne bearers of the gods are they. They stand in the highway to befoul the path. Evil are they, evil are they. By heaven be ye exorcised. And my moth people, welcome to Noctivagant, the show about the strange, paranormal, otherworldly, and the people who write books about it. My name's Jay, and I am joined by the draconic duo Nick and Rory.
Rawr.
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 Oh.
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 Oh, for fuck's sake. Oh, for fuck's sake. No.
At least I'm not drowning. I'll be a fabulous dragon over being drowning.
Every dragon is fabulous, thank you.
On this show, we are going to discuss, dissect, and review the best and worst in the world of paranormal and conspiracy literature. So settle in, buckle up, and prepare for a walk on the midnight roads of Noctivagant. Welcome back to Serpents of the Sky, Dragons of the Earth, here on Noctivagant.
Part 2.
Wow, that was nice. We didn't even practice that.
I know. We're on the same wavelength right now.
Yeah, those computer chips I've been putting into your brain are starting to pay off.
You're not supposed to tell people that we're on the trial of Elon Musk's Neuralink.
I would never in a million years let anything he built go into my brain.
Correct.
Me neither. No, it's why I took the circuit board out of my computer and I just inserted it through your forehead with a mallet.
Oh, is that what that headache I've had for the last 3 weeks is?
Yeah, it's also why I can now run Linux on you.
Oh, interesting. Is that why I've been doing so terrible at my job recently?
Yeah, typically speaking, your concentration drops by about 75% every time I boot up Doom.
Why are you doing this to me?
Oh, I don't know. Boredom.
We all do weird shit when we're bored.
And
like,
see,
you know, torture our friends.
Well, there's the thing. This is the core difference between Jay and I, is that I know I shouldn't be in charge because I'll be an unethical monster. Jay wants to be in charge so they can be an unethical monster.
Oh. And this is why I'm in charge.
No, that's why we let you think you're in charge.
Right.
I will lead us to the future, whether the rest of them want to go there or not.
That sounds dangerous.
Just a little dictatory.
Yeah. A little fascist.
Listen, all I'm saying is that the school system needs to be fixed. And if I have to put, you know, certain state governors in prison in order to accomplish that, well, you know.
Good.
I'm really not going to stop.
Yeah, really. If you keep the unconstitutional arrests to certain pie charts of the population, no one's going to give a shit.
Yeah.
I will mandate nap time as a human right within the continental United States. Alaska and Hawaii are on their own.
You are losing me.
Yeah, I here's the thing is like, well, I like naps when I take them, right? Convincing me to take one is a Herculean effort.
No,
because I don't want to waste time.
I'll mandate that it's a human right, meaning that much like a lunch break, you are allowed to tell your boss, I'm leaving so I can take a nap, and they can't stop you. But if you don't want to take a nap, you don't have to. You can just stay at work, or you can lie and leave and do something that's not.
I was about to say, we can't be in another smoker scenario where it's like, yeah, the smokers get all these extra breaks. People who don't smoke don't, which is why I always told my boss I'm taking an air break and they could fire me if they wanted to stop me.
Hmm. Well, this is all fine and good.
You know what this isn't about, though?
Dragons.
Or UFOs.
Yeah.
Or boobs.
That's true. And we've come full circle.
Yeah, we have. We really have.
Everything comes back to boobs with you.
Just today. It's the zeitgeist of the moment. I woke up today, I communed with the universe, and the universe said, you know what today's good for? Boobs.
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 Boobs. Yep. All right. Well, then, but really, we're here to talk about our buddy Holiday's book again.
Serpents of the Sky, Dragons of the Earth, and we are here for part two. We're going to get into what, in my opinion, is the more interesting and much more speculative half of the book. Because he laid out a pretty convincing argument, and now he's gonna extrapolate a lot in a lot of directions.
Yep. We closed last episode talking about how well has Holiday argued his stance so far, and regardless of his level of success, we have another leg of this journey to complete. Let's dive right back in with ley lines. What the fuck are ley lines? I certainly don't know, even though several of my friends have explained them to me several times, and even though Holiday tries to explain them to me too. Your other question is probably, what does this have to do with dragons? And that's clearer in this context, anyway. You see, as Holiday investigates how extensively this disc religion was practiced, he invites us to consider the standing stones of Great Britain. These rocks are everywhere. We have no idea why. We also have no idea why there's a pyramid of chalk in Silbury Hill. Building this shit was obviously a pain in the ass, and the ancient Britons took it a step further by lining this shit up with each other. Such alignments are attested to in the works of Norman Lockyer and Alfred Watkins, the latter of whom called the straight lines connecting ancient sites ley lines. Ley lines are often aligned with ancient footpaths, and were mathematically straight, as though drawn with a ruler. Oxford engineering professor Alexander Thom corroborates this and further states that many of the alignments point towards a line of descent of either the sun or the moon, or point to particularly bright stars in the night sky. Amy Michelle reports that UFO sightings can often have straight lines drawn between them, and Holiday's own sightings occurred on the path of Watkins' ley lines. Holiday again turns to mythology and religious texts for possible motives. In the Bible, both the prophet Jeremiah and the book of Psalms use the language of straight lines, straight paths, or straight ways to mean the good or correct way. If we operate under the lens of universality, we can infer that the Bronze Age Britons held similar beliefs. Holiday conducted his own investigation into the shape or layout of these alignments and found that the alignments in Britain seem to create a group of superimposed triangles, all pointing northwest, and Holiday feels that this indicates the direction from which the venerated sky disk would appear. The burial mounds being placed along the lines, then, could indicate that the dead were now under the entity's protection, or tutelage. And, for a fun bonus fact, we turn our eyes to Mars. On the planet's surface, we've observed a series of perfectly straight canals, which may or may not be natural. These canals also form overlapping triangles and greatly resemble Bronze Age ley lines when viewed from above. In 500 BCE, the disc religion began to decline. In Europe, this can largely be attributed to Roman imperialism, which continues to interfere with reconstruction efforts by modern Britons attempting to rediscover their culture. That which is burned is rarely recovered, and there is no such thing as a good or justified conquest. Free Palestine, if that wasn't clear. Call your reps and yell at them. Like, right now. Do that. As for how the disc and the dragon became linked as symbols of good and evil, respectively, we explore that in Chapter 11, using another ancient symbol. The Scandinavian Tree of Life, Yggdrasil. Yggdrasil's roots were in hell, where the dragon Nihagir chewed on them, as if to fell it. Holiday feels that the tree occurs as a symbol in multiple cultures, and yes, there's precedent there. One example, and I cannot speak to the validity of this interpretation, merely offer its existence, is the ziggurat of the Sumerians. The Sumerians painted the ziggurat in question in different colors, with the lowest levels being black, the mid-levels being red, and the crown being blue, with a dome-shaped shrine capping the whole thing. The gates at the foot of this structure were decorated with dragons. Dragons were also embroidered onto the robes of the priests at the lower levels. The dome at the top, Holiday theorizes, represents the cloud cigars. The base symbolizes dragons, and therefore the ziggurat is the tree of life slash the cosmos. What's not clear to me is if this is something that all ziggurats were made to look like in ancient Sumer, or if they were different. But this one, for this purposes, that's what that one looked like. Egyptian pyramids in this view also represent the cosmos, though not literally as the ziggurat in question did. Egyptian texts refer to them as houses of eternity or place of ascension, and they evolved from stepsile to uniform ascent, with each generation or pharaoh's reign making adjustments to the angle. Pyramids were also constructed by the Sudanese, by the indigenous people of the present-day Mississippi River Territory, and the Aztecs. In early Christianity, they were a holy symbol, and St. Patrick was allegedly wearing one when he arrived in Ireland. Their peak is said to be a place of enlightenment, and Holiday speculates that modern church spires may be a direct evolution of the pyramid symbol. Through this lens, Holiday feels confident in concluding that the Disc Tree Dragon Cult is the oldest religion of mankind and likely grew out of observance of UFO phenomenon. 40,000 years ago, the Neanderthals began to bury their dead in west-facing cemeteries, often with flowers adorning the bodies and bones and antlers decorating the graves. This, Holiday says, is the first evidence of sapient earthlings believing in an afterlife or non-physical reality, and asks us to consider what could have given us such an idea in the first place. And that's going to bring us to discussion question number 4. The idea of UFOs influencing human culture is not a new one, and we do need to discuss the implications. If the Disc religion is a real cult and is our oldest religion, what does that mean for us in the modern day? And was this influence deliberate, or was it as unintentional as the influence the sea has had on our cultures?
So if it's true, if we're operating under that paradigm, I mean, basically what that means and it, is that, I mean, I would see it more as being unintentional. They're here doing something, and they have, at least I'd hope it'd be unintentional. I guess that's more my wishful thinking, that if it's true, I hope it's unintentional, even though that does mean that the entire body and history and artwork of human religion is a cargo cult, effectively, which is, you know, that's certainly disheartening for a lot of people who are very, very invested in their core religion. Which is why I think that idea gets people going so much, right? Pisses people off so much. If it was intentional, oh boy, there's a whole lot of implications involved in that. And I mean, really, it comes down to what is the net goal? Is the net goal control? Was the net goal saying, hey, these savage war apes will never work together unless they have some unifying principles, so we'll give them religion, and that it was a way to stop us from basically murdering ourselves so our civilization could flourish? Or is it a means of control, saying there are now large sections of the population that believe we are the ultimate authority of the universe, and if we send them visions or visit them, they'll do what we say? I guess we don't know motive if it's intentional, and without that, it's really tough to get at the full implications. I think if knowledge of this ever got, you know, publicly accepted, I mean, I can't think of a single more destabilizing piece of knowledge to become public knowledge in the ever. I mean, you're talking about uprooting and dismantling the fundamental units by which we've organized our societies and ourselves and even our concept of self for as long as we have history. I mean, as much as I know everyone in this room, we're not, none of us are a member of organized religion per se, but, and we've all had bad experiences with it, but there's no denying the fact that without it, we don't have human civilization where we're at right now. But it was a key ontological and sociological tool by which to organize people and get large, impossibly large numbers of people all working in lockstep towards a shared goal. And without that, you don't get cities, you don't get agriculture, you don't get any of the modern things that we enjoy today. You know, there's this, and this is a bit of an aside, but I don't remember the area of the brain and what it's actually called, but there's an area of the brain that they found in primates that the size of that area of the brain is directly indicates the size of the social group that primate can form. So in chimps, you get a colony of about 20 to 50. That is about, and that really is the limit of how many individuals they can feel personal empathy towards and see them as an individual outside themselves before they become part of all the other chimps, which kind of get treated as a lump sum. And in humans, that number is about 150. And the reason that we're able to have civilization and work past it is because of things like religion, because we say, okay, I can't have an opinion about every single Catholic in the world, right? But let's say I am Catholic, and I can have a base assumption of what I think a Catholic is, how they'll behave, and how I'll treat them. And effectively, it's kind of like that distinction becomes a placeholder for all the Catholics everywhere. So it only takes up one slot of your 150 people. So you kind of start replacing individuals with populations about which you have these pre-existing ideas and attitudes about that shape how you interact with them, which is how we're able to have this sprawling civilization where, yeah, I know way more than 150 people, but I don't really. I know the population they're in and how that impacts how I interact with them, right? And I could see almost being, if it was intentional, it almost being like, aliens found a way to get us to create civilization by hacking, by using an exploit in our biology. In which case, I mean, the implications are massive. It really, I can't go too far down that road unless we know the motive. We know why they did it, because that changes everything. If it's, hey, we wanted you guys to have a fair shot at civilization, you know? Well, I'm sure a lot of people, and myself included, would have some bad feelings about that, thinking you had no right to interfere in our trajectory, you had no right to meddle with us, things like that. At the same time, I mean, I guess I'd get it a little more, if that makes sense, if this was actually something that we would not have been able to do without interference. But there's too many unknowns. I mean, there's just simply no way to reach a satisfying answer to that question.
Mm-hmm.
For me.
Well, I mean, what if it's like a both and situation? Like they have, you know, deliberately influenced aspects of our society so as to keep us on a path, whatever that path being, for whatever reason it is that they are doing it, you know, that unknown reason. Likely, you know, if contactees are correct, it just being that they want us to have some kind of society, right? And you know, grow better, be a part of the Galactic Federation, whatever. But because of their influence, we end up doing this thing where we turn them into gods.
Right.
You know, and then they're sitting there going, no, like that's not what I meant by that. You know, but at that point, it's too late. You know, it's taken off. It's become something great. Like, what if Jesus was just an ultra-terrestrial trying to put people on a path to self-enlightenment? And then, you know, what happened. And they're right. Just sitting there going, y'all missed the plot.
Like,
you know, like...
We're going to give you the technology for a steam engine because we think it's really going to help your agriculture. What's a warship?
Yeah, yeah. We're going to teach you how to use, we're going to give you the clues on how to split an atom so that you guys can have this this crazy power. What do you mean you're making a bomb?
Yeah, exactly. Also, I just looked it up. It's called Dunbar's number. Mm. That's the concept. It was proposed in the 90s by a British anthropologist. And there are some people who've pushed back against it, but there is a lot that indicates that while the specific number of 150 is variable, there is something to it.
Mm. So it's like, so I guess to the question, like what would, if this came to light, like what would it mean for us? And I think, Nick, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think it would be, it would unravel large swaths of the world. Like, there would be large sections of America that would be completely blown away to the point where we would probably see things like mass suicides and like crazy, crazy mind-shattering things just because there are so many people out there that have their entire life, their entire being, their entire everything is built on the idea that their religion is the one true religion, and that's it. So we would be, it would be undermining to them for their entire existence. And I mean, like, here's the thing. I don't necessarily think that there's aspects of this idea that's wrong. I think that there's parts of it that is true. We've talked about this all the time with the similarities between religions across the globe, that like there's too many similarities in the basic foundations of so many of these religions and faiths to deny that there is something else happening here between them. That being said, if we went and said that it was the influence is external and that external force is something like an alien or whatever, that would be, I think that would just be too much for some people. That being said, I think that there would be, theoretically, I think that there would be a way to do it. It would just be unbelievably slow because, like physical evolution, societal evolution happens slow.
Yeah. Well, and I do think in that theoretical future, we'd see a huge rise, not only in mass suicides, but also almost like religious city-states, like towns basically being like, no, that's not true here. Like, that where you're going to see congregations of people who can't live through that change of that mental, the change in the mental landscape, and would basically try to, ultimately would be a action driven by denial, would congregate into these small insular religious communities and try to act like nothing ever happened.
America would absolutely go to a civil war within hours of it happening because the conservative Christians will never accept it. They would never accept something like this to the point of, as proven, that there would be violence because of it.
Yep.
Yep. They would have the same reaction that a lot of creationists have to, you know, the presence of dinosaur bones or things like carbon dating or whatever they use to measure how old the earth actually is, of them being like, well, either those scientists are lying or Jesus is planting false evidence in order to test our faith, and it's actually probably both. So Jesus is testing us and the scientists are lying to us because the government wants to take our guns away and force us to gay marry our dogs. And
yes, gay marry your dogs.
Yep. So, because it, you know, it's even more unpalatable to marry an animal if it's a homosexual trans species union.
Homosexual.
So, yeah, this, I think this would be a really difficult revelation for people to kind of grapple with if this turned out to be true of like, oh no, our entire civilization, like every culture on earth, has been kind of guided and shaped by deliberate interference of another species that is coming from someplace else. That would be, and I think even setting aside the concept of like religion, I think just a lot of people would be really angry because it would be like, oh, so what? I'm some fucking science experiment. I'm a school project that's now collecting dust in mom's closet. Like, it feels dehumanizing and insulting. It's like, have I just been kept in a terrarium my entire life? Is this just a really fucked up intergalactic version of the goddamn Truman Show? Like, what are you doing and why are you doing this to me?
And that would be the biggest thing, is that with this information, would the why come? Because that would, that ultimately, I think, would tell us really how it would react. If it came down to, yeah, it was just a science experiment, well, then the world will, there'll be upheaval, there'll be revolt, there'll be violence. If there was some other explanation that, I don't know, was good, then maybe there would be less, but there wouldn't be none.
So this is an idea that's, again, like many of these, wildly unfounded. That just popped in my head. So we've talked before about, specifically I'm thinking of the DMT book, the idea of what if our ancestors, when they talk about the spirit world, when we talk about the afterlife, when we talk about where UFOs come from, we're talking about the same thing, the other layer. And what if that's all the same thing? And that's where we go when we die, which is why we see dead people during abduction experiences and things like that. Well, what if it's not so much we are being influenced by this outside thing? What if we are the snake eating its own tail? Because in that framework, the others are us and we are them. So what if really us, them doing this was basically us kickstarting the process here to reflect what's already happened there? So, you know what I mean? So, like, it's basically, yeah, we're being influenced, but it's still by us.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, humanity has always been the master of our destiny. It's just the fact that we don't have a grasp of what that word humanity means when you actually break it down.
I mean, I don't necessarily... I could say that falls in line with a lot of thinking that we've talked about on the show. The idea that, you know, maybe we pick our path like in between these lives, right? Would that not be the same thing when we're back in one with the greater unconsciousness, whatever you want to call it, once we're back into oneness with that and decide that we're going to go for another journey around, you know, around the wheel, that we're picking the influence that we're going to have the next time that we're here.
Right.
I mean, that's ultimately we're saying ultimately I feel like we're saying the same thing.
We are. You know? It's just, well, and I think that what we're trying to do specifically in this part of the conversation, and it's the same problem we have every time we talk about this, is that ultimately we can only try to describe this in human concepts.
Yeah.
And there's a big part of me that suspects that if that's true, whatever is over there is simply we don't have the language to discuss it properly its actuality.
And I agree. I think that a lot of like the esoteric side of all of this, like thinking about it, the spiritual side of all of this, I think so much of it comes down to eventually you have to accept that you're not going to know, because I don't believe that we're meant to.
At least not while alive.
Exactly. Like, while we're here, I'm not sure that we're meant to know the answers to these questions, because part of it is the journey.
Well, it might very well be that if you do follow the whole, you know, the reincarnation lines of thought, the whole idea that we come here for a reason, it could be that that reason is impossible if you know.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point. That's really interesting, too.
Yeah, so it could just be like we induce amnesia upon ourselves.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, who knows? Because maybe right now we're here, right? Maybe after this, we're going to go die. I mean, hopefully not soon. We go die, and then Jay is going to go back to being the Loch Ness Monster and making appearances there every now and then. And I'm going to go back to being a Sasquatch. And, I mean, Rory, I think... probably a moth person.
I can accept that.
Yeah.
Like, or just a rhino.
Yeah. Or just a rhino.
Yeah.
Not even a cryptid. Just
nope,
a rhino.
Just a rhino.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it could just be that, you know, where has Nessie been the last 10 years? There's been no sightings. Nessie decided to try to become a human. Got birthed. Sadly, it was in China. Didn't make it long. Now they're back.
Woof.
God damn, Nick.
Okay, so maybe I should have picked a fictional country where there aren't actual humanitarian crimes being committed.
Actively, as we speak.
Good luck finding one.
Also.
New Zealand!
ask the Maori people if there's not human rights violations going on in New Zealand, a.k.a. Stolen Chain of Islands number 17.
Admittedly, I shouldn't have picked a country that I know literally anything about. I know literally nothing about.
So you should have just picked the one you do and still been wrong?
There are no human rights violations in Hyrule.
There you go. Though.
God damn it!
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure.
The Mushroom Kingdom!
That's also a displaced indigenous population, if I'm remembering right.
If you, I'm pretty sure the Goombas and the 40 million that Mario has killed would disagree.
God damn it. There has to be at least one setting that isn't on some level a crime.
Equestria.
I refuse to live there.
I mean, without conflict, it wouldn't be a very interesting world.
Yeah, I'll make the conflict. That's what it is. I'll go to one of these peaceful places, and I'll be the villain.
There you go. That's an idea.
And I know what would happen in Equestria or something. I'd show up there, make one bad joke, and then I'd get my, what are they called, the little tattoos.
Cutie marks.
I'd get my cutie mark, and it would be something like a dildo or something like that, and it would my anger over it would drive me to mass murder.
Princess Celestia is going to stomp you to death with her hooves.
I'm going to make her into glue.
She's a sun goddess, so good luck with that.
Good glue.
So, are we ready for part five?
I think we might be ready for part five.
A horse is a horse!
Jay, did you answer this question?
I did. I did sort of, yeah, it's...
I mean, feel free. Obviously, it's your episode. Do what you want here.
I think this would cause a lot of massive upheaval. And what's interesting is, you know, I've mentioned the first culture hypothesis several times on this show. I actually did my research and tried to fact check myself. The primary guy behind that theory in the modern age is Professor E.J.M. Witzel, who wrote The Origin of World Mythologies. If you want a summary for it, feel free to message me on Tumblr or on our Discord or whatever, and I'll send you the link for the free e-published book of an anthropology textbook where one of the chapters gives a very nice summary of that particular theory. If you want to look from a non-involving UFOs, like strictly materialist perspective on some of the modern theoretical approaches to why we're seeing those common themes, Nolan Weil's textbook is a pretty good starting point for that, but that still doesn't necessarily answer the question of if there is this original ancient African society from which all of our mythology is descended. It still doesn't entirely explain why they were apparently so obsessed with flaming discs in the sky. So that's intriguing. There's another theory that basically posits that these themes are just the result of humans having very parallel psychology because we're the same species, and kind of this idea of we all see the sun, we all see water, we all see the ground and fire and disease, and our brains can only come up with so many different kind of cultural motifs and explanations for why we're seeing this stuff, and that these parallel sounding myths may have just occurred organically because that's just how our species approaches the world, and that's just how our brains default to interpreting that stuff. But that theory also has a lot of holes in the terms of other psychological phenomenon across world cultures is not that parallel, and so there's just, but
it,
yeah.
I mean, also, I don't buy that just because, I mean, you take literally any part of reality, and you will find people who disagree about its fundamental nature.
That is true.
We are very creative monkeys, and we can convince ourselves of a great many of interpretations. That's not a sun god. The actual god is the dark between the stars. That's God's butthole.
And Nolan Wiles does express in his book some pretty significant skepticism for that theory. The one theory that he doesn't throw it right in the trash, because you're not supposed to do that as an academic unless there's a very large consensus reach. The theory that he's holding directly over the trash can, primed to let it go, is the idea that after the mass immigration out of the Fertile Crescent, that dominant cultures like Rome and the Chinese Empire and Sumer spread their myths out to hunter-gatherer tribes and smaller civilizations. He he more or less finds a polite way to say that's kind of racist and reductive and doesn't actually make a lot of sense, but it's something that white Christian historians really liked for a long time.
My biggest issue with the second theory, the one where we all, like, there's only so much that we can say, is I don't think I can believe the idea that it's just a coincidence being the explanation for the similarities between, like, faiths and stuff like that. Like, that doesn't, that feels disingenuous. It feels reductive, you know?
Yeah, and I can agree with that. I think right now, if I'm looking at it from, like, a strictly materialist standpoint, I think I'm kind of, I'm trying to harmonize the first culture theory with kind of the human psychology theory, that it was those two things working together,
yeah,
that led to a lot of this parallel stuff, because it's entirely possible that the reason our psychology occasionally comes up with these culture, with these parallels across different cultures, is because we share a root culture.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, I mean, first culture makes, probably out of the three there, makes the most sense to me.
Yeah.
And I feel like historically there is precedent, you know?
Yeah. I agree with you too. It's going to be a slog to get through probably, but I am going to be ordering the actual Origin of World Mythologies book and forcing myself to get through it, because I talk about this theory a lot. I quite like it based on my, at this time, surface level understanding of it, and I want to be able to actually understand it so I can use it to articulate some of the points I want to make better, because I think, and I was looking into this, the guy has been refuted, but not a lot. And a lot of the people that are refuting him are, like, deeply religious people who refuted him by sending him death threats.
Mm. So, how long is the book? I mean, I'm just curious. I don't know if it would be a good one for the show, but it sounds interesting.
I want to see if maybe we can do it on the show, because that would be, I think it would be interesting. And in terms of its page count, it's 688 pages.
So it'd be like a 3 or 4 parter.
Yeah, it would be like a 3 or 4 parter, and we would have to give ourselves a lot of lead time to be able to read through it, because, again, this is
it's an academic book.
Yeah, it's very dense. Like, this is something where you're a lot of me included, it's like I can get through 20 or 30 pages of this at a time, and then I have to stop because it's just a lot.
No, we can talk about it. Could be interesting.
Yeah. But are we ready for part 5?
Let's do it.
All right. In chapter 12, we meet a version of Holiday who no longer believes that the water monsters are physically real, undiscovered animals. Instead, he has come more into alignment with the ancient Celtic view, namely that they were apparitions, or able to come and go from physical reality at will. He recounts eyewitness accounts that involve the creatures vanishing when someone draws close, and reminds us of the creature's spooky tendency to evade recording equipment. They manage it far too often for it to be chance or human incompetence, Holiday reasons, and he walks us through several examples, the most baffling of which is the one that follows. The classic and unique evasion must certainly be the McRae film. Obtained in the 1930s by a retired Harley Street physician, every attempt to have this film shown to a panel of zoologists, if necessary in secret, has failed. Nevertheless, I believe such a film exists, and that it represents the most extreme example of evasion we know. And I must say, this McRae film thing, this is either, like, very strong evidence that some sort of gremlin has been assigned the task of preventing any serious scientist from ever viewing this film, or some person out there has been playing a nearly 100-year prank on the entire cryptozoological community, and is somehow, it just reminds me of this one guy in, like, the 50s that claimed he'd captured a local cryptid in his barn, and he would tell people, it's like, all right, now that you've all bought your tickets, I'm going to go inside the shed here and see if the hodag is ready for visitors. And then he goes inside, and he would have a nice new suit on every time, and he goes strutting inside, and then everyone outside would hear, no, down, hodag, bad hodag, no, help, the claws, the teeth, and it's just like banging and tearing and screaming. And then the guy would come out, and his suit is all shredded to shit, and he's just like, the hodag is in no mood for visitors today. He would just go in there and tear his own suit up. There was not a horrible grinning frog demon inside that shack. He was just putting on a show. And
snake oil.
So that was a man who every day was doing the liar liar bit to himself.
Yes.
Yes.
What are you doing?
Day.
I'm kicking my ass.
Do you mind?
Yeah. He would just kick his own ass and shred his own suit every day. And you know what? If I lived in that guy's town, I would go once a week just to hear him scream.
Absolutely.
I'd be there fucking daily.
Yeah.
Are you kidding? No, I'm going to make you beat yourself into a coma till you give up on this.
For real. Like, I'd bring my own popcorn. Like, it's good. Let's go.
I'm taking a step up. Like, he's about to walk in there. I'm handing him a battle mace. Take this.
Yeah.
Don't worry. I'm sure the hodag won't use it on you, right?
I would beg to be involved in the bit. I would be like, please, just like let me and some of my friends that I trust pretend to go in for like a one-on-one audience with the hodag. I will punch myself in the eye. I don't give a shit.
I will come if I am motivated enough. I will come out on fire.
It's true. You probably would.
And
I'd regret it.
Yeah,
I'd regret it during the skin grafts.
Yeah,
but
in the heat of the moment, you've done some truly intelligent things.
Within me, there are two wolves. One is an academic. The other is an idiot. And unfortunately, the academic is sleepy and often napping.
Yeah.
And that's just what the McRae film reminds me of. Again, it's either legitimately there is something cursed about this footage, and no one who has doctor in front of their name is able to look at it. Or just one guy, and now I would assume a legacy of people is just like, all right, we can't let anyone know that this reel is just of a delightful family of ducks swimming around in a pond in the English countryside. So dazzle me, people. What's going to go wrong this time? A sudden ice storm.
So, quack, motherfucker.
You are hitting, though, on something that we haven't talked about too much. Because it's easy to disregard with Occam's razor. There is a weird propensity for an awful lot of paranormal evidence to go missing or to suddenly be corrupted and not viewable. And of course, the Occam's razor answer is it wasn't real. And when pressed, the person who has it had to make up something. But what if in some of those cases, if not most of them, that isn't the case? What if this is an example of the phenomenon actively resisting being disclosed? And that, we're talking about ice storms, things like that. Literally, reality adjusts to do what it can to prevent anybody from getting hard evidence of something else, of capital P phenomenon going on.
Well, if we can't know.
Yeah.
Because it would impact our ability to fulfill our purpose. Our journey, the reason why we're here, if knowing that would, knowing the information or getting too much evidence would interfere with it, then it makes sense that we, the big we, mm-hmm. right? We in the sky.
The capital W we.
Yeah, would prevent that from happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that totally makes sense to me, and unfortunately, it also makes me think of like our tabletop RPG games, the World of Darkness games. You know, in Mage, Quintessence protects itself, the weird protects itself. Like,
yep.
This is a reoccurring theme even in those games.
Well, we've talked about the fact that at least somebody who was involved in writing those books is as into this shit as we are.
Absolutely.
There's so much actual reference to actual occultism and actual theosophy and idealism. It's crazy.
Oh yeah.
I've told you guys about the time that I was at the doctor's office for a checkup, and they hooked me up to three different blood pressure machines, and All three of the blood pressure machines told the doctor quite insistently, this patient does not have a heartbeat. Three different machines was like, this patient does not have a heartbeat. And he ended up like, I think he ended up taking it from my wrist, like my pulse, and just did a bunch of math on paper to figure out what was going on, because he was like, okay, something's wrong with all three of these machines. And even as the patient who had a heartbeat and was definitely not the undead, I was sitting there going like, three different machines in a row told you I don't have a heartbeat. And your assumption is just all three of your machines, which were working fine throughout the entire rest of this week, spontaneously all malfunctioned in a very weird, specific way right in a row. And it's just we're just not going to address that further. Just nothing about that is going to strike you as odd. You're just going to do the math on the paper and move the fuck on with the rest of my physical.
Well, when you only get 15 minutes a patient, that's what you get.
Yeah,
that's entirely fair. That is entirely fair.
I mean, well, and it's not to jump back, but also, I mean, how many people have we talked to for midnight chats who tell us either on air or off that, you know, that they often, when talking about this sort of stuff, have technical problems that happen only when talking about it. And we've experienced that too.
Oh yeah.
We there have been so many weird audio and technical glitches that only seem to happen during interviews.
Yep.
Not when we're talking to each other. And there's no reason having Zoom running on your computer should do that.
Especially not my gaming computer, you know. Yeah. That I have going on here.
Yeah, no, so it does almost feel like there might be something to that. I would think it's probably, like everything, it's somewhere in the middle. Probably about half the people are lying. And then the other half, who knows? Maybe they actually had something or have something, but they just can't get it out. And if that's the case, can you imagine how fucking nutty that'd drive you? Can you imagine if you had a picture of the Sasquatch taking a shower in your bathroom? And you've had this, and you show it to people, and they immediately say fake, or when you try to show it to them, something goes wrong. The sun blinds in their eyes. The wind blows the picture away. You just can't show it to anyone, no matter what you do.
Holiday talks in this book about one of the researchers on Loch Ness got what was pretty solid footage, and when they played it back later, the reel showed nothing. Like, for some reason, something had happened to the film and every frame was blank. And they were like, what the fuck? This has never happened before.
But we hear stories like that all the time. Like, especially in, like, ghosts, people will be like, they'll take a picture. They'll look at it on the, you know, if it's a digital camera, they'll look at the digital camera of it and they'll see something. And then they'll go to the computer and put it in, and whatever it was that they saw, or sometimes that entire photo is just not there anymore.
So I had a similar experience to something like that, actually, at the Stanley Hotel in Colorado. So I went there. For those who don't know, the Stanley Hotel is a big old haunted hotel that was the inspiration for The Shining.
Yep.
It is the Overlook Hotel, effectively.
Where Connor and Carl from Hellier worked for years.
Yep. And, I took tons of pictures on the ghost tour and all that. I didn't get anything. But right before the ghost tour, by the box office, they had a door, that, like, frosted glass door, that was to Madame Vera, I believe was her name. And she was the resident psychic at the time when I was there. They had a psychic on staff.
Neat.
And when I took a picture of her door, my screen went black, then blue, then my phone turned off. Hmm. And when I turned it back on, that picture wasn't there.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. And I've never seen that glitch before or since on any iPhone.
Hmm. It's a coincidence.
Yeah, probably. But yeah, have we?
That wasn't even a question.
Have we even answered the question?
There wasn't a question.
Oh God, we're still in the middle of the summary.
Yes.
I apologize. Please, let's move forward.
But many argue these creatures also have mass. How else could they snap oars, sink buoys, kill shepherds? And how are they themselves killed if they are immaterial? Holiday isn't sure, but does wonder if the slaying of ancient dragons may have been a misunderstood description of an exorcism. After all, Celtic literature refers to these things as apparitions. The slayings that we're reading about could just be magical work meant to drive off unclean or harmful spirits.
That's certainly, sorry, I was just thinking because, you know, he says Celtic literature suggests, and I'm just going, what?
There is no Celtic literature.
Yeah, I think when he's doing that, he's largely referring to, like, pre-Christian or early post-Christian poetry and like stories that got passed down orally and then were written down, but I agree.
That's the only thing that it can be.
Yeah.
So.
But I agree that like referring to that as literature is likely quite an inaccurate term.
Yeah.
Furthermore, he can draw many parallels between water monster sightings and UFO sightings. Animals grow agitated. The objects in question may change color or size. Both seem to consciously avoid film capture, but have shown up on sonar. Both also have a profound impact on witnesses, causing a form of ontological shock. Witnesses have nightmares, flashbacks, and other symptoms of trauma. Many witnesses initially do not tell anyone else as if compelled to hide these sightings. And that was another point that I was going to bring up is, what if the reason some of this evidence vanishes is because people have a weird compulsion to destroy it or hide it?
Yeah. Yeah. And then don't even know that they did it or something.
Right.
Like, especially like, you know, thinking about how often that happens with like alien abductions and stuff like that, like could see. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and think about how many times someone who's been abducted there, when they come back from missing time, I've read many of stories where they came back from missing time and it wasn't like they came back from missing time right after the event was done. They came back from missing time an hour after that, and they had been doing things and talking to people during that time that they have no memory of.
Driving
yeah. places.
Yeah.
Ugh. Many Loch Ness researchers insist that the monster's evasion of camera equipment is merely a coincidence and refuse to entertain the idea that the creatures are anything other than flesh and blood animals. But to Holiday, calling this much evasion coincidence is beyond ridiculous. Decades of nearly round-the-clock monitoring of Loch's Ness and Morar, not a single clear photo. But the one day the cams are down for maintenance, an entire hotel sees a water monster clear as day. That's not coincidence. That's a pattern. While Holiday has become skeptical of the creature's nature as a physical animal, he allows for some further entertainment of it for the purposes of this book. In regard to the question of their food source, he cites a conversation with biologist Dr. David Piggins, who assures him that there's no evidence of such an animal predating Great Britain's fish. Perhaps they are sediment feeders, eating the organic ooze found at the bottom of several of the lakes in question. If they are worm-like, as an earthworm, they may lack a skeleton or have very few bones, and therefore not leave any remains behind. Holiday tells us that while we may not like all of the spooky action at play here, we cannot simply discard thousands of years of human tradition because it's convenient. These things have been seen over and over again for many centuries, and he feels that that in and of itself is evidence. That does, however, hinge on an accurate account of a culture's history and the ability to understand said history within said culture's context. In Chapter 13, The Serpent People, we don't quite find that. Holiday starts off with an accurate statement. We cannot assume all Bronze Age cultures worshipped the disc. I must remind our listeners that I am summarizing Holiday's assertions, not corroborating them. Holiday then asserts that the Bronze Age cultures that did not worship the disc instead worshipped the dragon. For example, he states that the city of Ur, a Sumerian city-state, was forced to worship the serpent by Narbondanus, the last of the Chaldean kings, and that only the intervention of Cyrus of Persia restored order, aka disc worship, to the region. Holiday further traces the serpent priests to Rome, circa 133 BCE, where the snake was credited with ending a plague, thus creating an avalanche of snake worship in ancient Rome. The god, called the Asclepian Serpent by Holiday, is shown in carvings in Pompeii to have three humps and two small horns. Holiday tells us that while he's been treating snakes and worms and dragons as virtually the same thing for this entire book, to not worry about the fact that many cultures, including the ones we're presently discussing, viewed serpents as holy creatures with entirely positive connotations. Nobody realized they were worshiping a dragon, he insists. Dragons and snakes weren't thought to be the same thing. Holiday further tells us that from Rome, dragon worship spread and persisted long past the dawn of Christianity. He tells us that it is through exiled Jews in Ur that we got the association with goats. Apparently, water horses or dragons presented to them as goats, which led to witches in the Middle Ages having orgies with warlock priests dressed in goat costumes, obviously. I'm having a lot of thoughts, but I digress.
Hey, this is the stretching bit.
Just as a quick aside, most of what modern Western Christian cultures describe as Middle Ages witchcraft with goat orgies and eating babies and that shit, that didn't happen. That shit did not happen. Like, read witchcraft in early modern Europe. It's a slog, but it will walk you through how this didn't happen. According to Holliday's analysis, the appeal of dragon worship would be the lack of a religious moral code, and the fact that Satan is thought to be more powerful than God while on earth. For this latter part, he references 2 Corinthians verse 4, chapter 4, and this translation is consistent across most versions. Knowledge of Bronze Age Satanism, as Holliday calls it, is based entirely on archaeology, namely statues of dragons and ancient architecture bearing their images. Therefore, Holliday concludes, a parallel group to the disc cult existed, one that worshipped the dragon. Furthermore, both cults eventually reached the New World. He cites the Sioux ghost shirts, bearing images of a radiating disc, rising smoke and a fire burning underneath, a horseman, and a zigzag at the bottom for the dragon, serpent, water horse, big-ass eel, ghost worm. That's what zigzag is. It's all those things and more. Holliday seems to believe that every ghost shirt looked like this. Google ghost shirt, or Bing it, or ask a librarian, or go to the South Dakota State Heritage Society's museum or some shit and look at them. Anyway, there was also a massive earthwork in Pebbles, Ohio. Long squiggle line, capped in spirals. Also, in 1675, a French missionary said that at the confluence of the Ohio and Mississippi rivers, he found hieroglyphics of dragons painted in green, red, and black. These are gone. We destroyed them so we could mine shit out of the ground. Anyway, check out our Tumblr or our Twitters for some organizations I'll be linking, orgs that need money in order to address the problems caused by shit like that. Moving on, Holliday does not think dragon worship ever ended. He cites Aleister Crowley as evidence of its endurance and blames Crowley's failure of Dr. D's Abralum ritual for the mountain-climbing lunatic's downward spiral. I personally blame snow madness. Nobody spends that much time on those craggy death spikes and comes down normal. Ignoring Crowley's snow madness, Holliday tells us of a strange altar cloth found in the graveyard below the Bullskin house. Two serpents with humps. The cloth was stained and had been wrapped around a conch shell carved with grooves and lotus blossoms. The curator of the Inverness Museum had it examined on Holliday's behalf. Allegedly, it had come from Turkey, which St. John, the gospel writer, not the author of Revelation, called Satan's seat. Later, Holliday encounters some medium elevation strangeness. He meets a descendant of Dr. D, and then sees the name D spelled out in a reflection on dark water. And you know what? Actually, the elevation on that strangeness might be higher than I give it credit for. That's weird, and Holliday doesn't like coincidences. Maybe they're too much like binaries, which he also doesn't like. He even quotes Louis Pouvel's and Jacques Bourget's The Dawn of Magic. We are neither materialists nor spiritualists. These distinctions no longer have any meaning for us. Quite simply, we seek reality while avoiding the conditioned reflex of the modern man, in our opinion, behind the times, who turns away as soon as reality takes on a fantastic air. In summation, Holliday thinks we should be ready to embrace both the hard realities of our then space, now digital age, and the Elish mysteries of the bygone Bronze Age. After all, we finally made it to the stars, but we're still chasing discs. Discussion question number 5. So something I often find myself worrying about is the dangers of overgeneralizing when it comes to some of our research into other cultures and their mythologies. We often look for common themes across cultures to verify our findings, but we run the risk of viewing everything through our own cultural lens and then connecting dots that aren't really dots at all. See Holiday referring to these ancient snake cults as Satanism. How do we control for that when we're doing this sort of research?
That's another good question. And I think it's really difficult because we can only analyze these things through the context of what we understand. At least in my understanding, right?
Yeah.
That being said, I think we can control for that by looking at counterpoints of view of things, not only reading the things that are in line with our worldview that have a tilt to our worldview, but rather looking at counterpoints to the topic that we're in, whatever we're talking about. Like, you know, we dog on Nuts and Bolts, but we have read Nuts and Bolts books. You know, I think that's a good example. And I think that's kind of the best way that we can. And then also, obviously, keeping an open mind to everything so that when somebody comes on the show and, you know, maybe they have some cultural experience that we don't, we have to make sure that we have an open mind to listen to them and take what they say to heart, because ultimately, if they, you know, if they're the expert, they're going to know better than us, because no matter what we do, our bias, our understanding, our own cultural framework, our upbringing is going to skew how we take this stuff in, how we are going to understand it. Like, it's impossible. It is next to impossible for me not to, when I see things like this, like you said, like with the whole Satanism stuff, to not sit there and immediately discredit something just because either, you know, using the terminology Satanism wrong, which he is, or noticing throughout this how much of this is skewed in a Christian light. And then for me, because of my personal disagreements with the faith or with the organized religion, not even with the faith itself, not to immediately discredit something like that. I have to fight through that because of my own personal biases and things like that. And that's the only thing that we can do, is acknowledge that these are things that we have, and then seek, at least I say the only thing that I know that we can do for certain is acknowledge that these are things that we have, they're biases that we have, it's something that will ultimately skew our opinion. And then seek out ways to gain more knowledge, more understanding, to help us fully grasp whatever it is, especially seeking out things that are more culturally appropriate.
Yeah, I think I agree, because I was trying to think of, is there a way to necessarily separate yourself, your investigation, from your biases? And yeah, you're going to want to be conscious of what your biases are, but even then, unconscious ones will influence how you view basal reality. I was thinking, well, what if, you know, AI will be the way that we solve this? Because then we'll be able to develop an impartial view of things. But at the same time, will it? Because what information has that AI learned off of? That's going to dictate a lot of what the pieces that it has to put together.
The groundwork for which it was coded is going to have a basis for it.
Yep, because human bias is in everything we make.
Yeah, they've proven that AIs can have bias. They've proven that AIs with facial recognition and analysis software behave differently when they're analyzing photos of people of color versus white people, because the majority of people who are coding that software are white.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I think probably the best way to guard against it, and this is something that it's not in the, I hesitate even to phrase it like this, it's not in the culture of the type of the people who tend to write these books, in that, you know, we've read the work of Keel, we've read the work of Vallée, we've read the work of all these guys. And what is one of the common themes that comes up is the image of the lone investigator out there talking to UFO witnesses and you know, Keel with his fedora prowling around Point Pleasant.
Being chased by bulls.
Ultimately, if you are alone in your search, you are only able to bring what you already had to that search. I think that the way to get around it is simple numbers. If I'm going to go investigate a djinn, I shouldn't be going there alone. I should be taking someone of the Muslim faith. I should be taking as well as an anthropologist and an occultist and a historian. And unfortunately, because a huge number of people that we've met in our community are not what I would call extroverts, who are going to be up for gathering up a dream team and going out there. But I really think that what hurts us is this image of the lone investigator, the lone academic striving for the truth. Because at the end of the day, you have no way of knowing if you're walking down a blind alley that because you have blinders on, whether you want to or not, whether you try to remove them or not. Every human being has blinders on to facets of reality, to ways of thinking that we simply have never encountered or are contrary to what we innately believe to be how one should conduct themselves, how one should view reality. I would say the answer is get friends and make it into a group activity. And then you're still going to have to be combating now with many, many more biases, but it should be easier then to identify those biases because you're seeing them in others and others are seeing yours in you. And you can, if you are a group of rational and stable people who are comfortable enough to talk about that with each other, then you might be able to start drilling past all those various biases to get at some nugget of truth, something that sits at the center of it.
Yeah, and that's kind of my point, my thinking too, is even if you don't gather up a dream team to kind of like the dream team for the investigations, that's also great. But it also needs to be a team effort when it comes to academic research, by which I mean you need to check other voices in the field and see what they're saying, particularly if like Holiday is doing something that is not uncommon in academic circles, where in order to fully make his point, he has to step slightly outside of his personal field of expertise. And in those cases, it's best to check statements and assertions that he's making against the statements and assertions made by people who have made that specific field their entire life. Like him talking about the snake cult in Rome, something about that didn't quite sit right with me. So I went digging and I found what I'm pretty sure is the religious movement he was talking about. And from what I was reading, one, it came from Macedonia, not anywhere out from where the Sumerian civilization was located. And two, even at the time it was popular, a lot of the Roman citizens engaged with it. It was coming across as more of a fad religion, kind of like the modern Satanic Temple is for a lot of people. Of like Roman elites were doing this largely because they thought it was funny and it was something to talk about at parties, not necessarily something they were taking seriously. And it also doesn't sit right with me, his assertion that, well, for the purposes of what we're talking about, snakes and worms and dragons need to be treated as the same thing. But when we get into these cultures like, you know, Babylon, that are like dragons bad, serpents good, we have to understand that they didn't know what they were talking about and that they were confused. And it's like, buddy, anytime you are talking about a foreign ancient culture and you're explaining holes in your theories by saying, oh, they're confused, that's automatically bad academia on the simple basis of it's racist and insulting. And furthermore, I got the point that I got most frustrated with when he went, well, it's easy to understand why people would worship the dragon instead of the disc, because if you're worshiping the dragon, you don't have to adhere to any sort of moral code. And also the Bible says that the devil's more powerful than God on earth. So that's why you do that. And it's like, Holiday, you cannot use evidence specifically from the Christian part of the Bible to explain the behavior of ancient Sumerians. That's not how that works. Like, and yeah, just if it's like, well, obviously they followed this religion because it wouldn't give them a moral code. And this is one of the things that I was talking about in previous episodes. When it comes to vetting your sources, this is also what I'm talking about. Of Holiday is a, he grew up culturally Christian. He clearly has a lot of struggles with Christianity as a religion, but it's still clearly the thing most greatly informing his views here. And the bias is quite clear. And that's something we kind of have to take into consideration with our sources. Is there a very obvious bias here that's informing the conclusions that they're drawing? And again, circling back to the actual question, that's why in an ideal world, we need to constantly be checking these assertions against other voices in the same and related fields, because you can't, sometimes one guy gets a theory in their head and they just run with it for their entire career, and they're very insistent that this is what's happening. And then less than a generation later, new research comes out that just completely knocks it out at the knees. Mm-hmm.
I agree. Good points all around.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Point is, it's hard.
Yeah. The answer we got to was, I don't. At least you're trying.
Yeah, it's just like, even just check the Wikipedia page. Check the sources linked at the bottom of the Wikipedia page. Is there a section of the Wikipedia page that starts off with false assertions made by F.W. Holiday within the context of this field of study? Like,
yeah.
All right. Have we gotten everything we're going to get out of that question for right now?
I think so. I am ready for us to race into the last part here.
Last section, and it's the last chapter of the book. All right. For his final chapter, Holiday muses about how much it would fuck up everyone's day if dragons were real. He quotes Valet, who often said that mass belief in the reality of UFOs would disrupt society on multiple levels and in multiple spheres. Valet also discussed at length the community bias scientists hold against these topics, and Holiday agrees with him. We don't know what the discs are or what they really want. Holiday sought out some contactees to see what they had to say about it, and didn't like what he found. Possible cult leader Dr. George King said he was a prophet, guided by spiritual messengers he called cosmic masters. It gets better from there, but I don't have time to be intense about it right now. Most contactees sound that way to Holiday, and he compares them to Moses, who preached morality while killing neighboring tribes. And that's a complicated issue that I also don't have time to be intense about right now, and it's also outside of my field of expertise. What bothers Holiday now is the fact that the discs won't tell us what they want. They're obviously intelligent, he asserts, but instead of other planets, he wonders if they're from an invisible other world and are only here sometimes. They alternate between having mass and being ephemeral. One couple in New Jersey witnessed a vaguely egg-shaped craft flying overhead. It faded in and out of not just view, but existence, as far as they could tell. Similar reports are found for water monsters and many other cryptids and, you know, every ghost ever. They all fucking do that. It's their one trick. While the Condon report had multiple reports of a similar nature put in front of them, they still ultimately concluded that UFOs were of no significance and belonged in the category of fiction. Holiday thinks of it as willful ignorance, born out of either fear or pride. He hoped this would change. After all, Carl Jung had come to believe in ghosts, or, well, in something both real and non-material by the end of his life, and the birth of quantum theory meant that a whole new world was being explored for the first time. Surely this would end materialism, right? Well, I'm from the future. Sorry, guy. Holiday believed all sides of the phenomenon shared a common root, hence their parallel features. He tells us of a strange story here. On October 7th, 1965, several things happened very close together. A woman called Annabelle Randall and a friend were driving over a bridge that... You know that one intersection or bridge or tree in your hometown, the one that kept killing people? Yeah, that was the bridge. Anyway, she saw a ghost, bloody dude, lying in the road. You know the deal. He flickered out of sight, so, you know, no need for an ambulance. He's digital now. Keep driving. But later, she went back, you know, to check. And some fucking orange ball just decides to shoot through the sky overhead like, hi, I'm here too. And because that's not enough shit, there was this big dark thing hanging in place overhead. And these two menacing silhouettes walking towards her in weird clothes and fucked up hats. And then Annabelle did the correct thing and drove the fuck away. Also, a month later, a mile away from Dead Guy Bridge, a retired Royal Air Force captain and his wife see a tall, dark figure in a mask and a different bloody guy in the road. And then those things had the courtesy to blink the fuck out of existence and stay in their appropriate genres from now on.
It turns out all of this was because, like, they're all ultra-terrestrials, and the reason they're in the area is, like, something, the rough equivalent, like, one of them dropped their fucking contact lens, and the rest of them are canvassing this area trying to find the interdimensional contact lens.
At some point, we gotta tell his mom he lost it. I know it's gone, but this is the fourth one he's lost this year, and we just need to give him a couple of more hours before we tell him he has to tell his mom.
I don't know. I'm not supposed to be out driving the giant plasma ball. I took it from my dad. I got to get it home before he gets back from space work.
Did you not tell your dad that you were taking the plasma ball?
I did not. No. And
oh my fucking god.
Yeah. No. We didn't tell him we were taking the plasma ball, the giant dark craft, or the rectal prober.
Guys, I just checked. We're not supposed to be in this country at all. Oh, god damn it. Okay, so we're just breaking every fucking law, I guess.
Wait, what planet are we on?
Earth.
Oh, fuck. We gotta get the hell out of here.
Yeah, everything on this planet is protected.
Code red. Code red.
The U.S. military took my fucking saucer. You can't have shit on Earth.
It's just teenagers who don't know how to drive. That I'm caught.
Always.
Every single UFO crash is either they were drunk coming home from a New Year's party, or they're 14 years old and they have a learner's permit and they were not supposed to be driving without an adult in the front seat.
I buy it for now.
Turning to Irish and Scandinavian mythology, Holiday wonders if UFOs are acting as Valkyries, rescuing those who died violently and breaking them out of their loops. One of Holiday's own UFO encounters happened mere days before and in very close proximity to a disaster that killed 116 children and 28 adults in the Welsh countryside. And the Torah does tell us that no man may look upon God's face, and for the purposes of this book, the disc is God. And God is not breaking the laws of physics, Holiday tells us. The difference between mass and massless is merely blurrier than we thought. UFOs are merely hard light, concrete sometimes, and ephemeral when they need to be. Again, they share this with ghosts, which walk through walls and break plates. What we should abandon, Holiday tells us, is any firm belief in UFOs coming from outer space. They may come from another dimension, another wavelength, or even another time. He cites Carl Jung again, who wrote of an eternal now, and he cites Yale professor Marganow, who attested that multidimensional time was entirely possible. Quantum theory, too, supports a more complicated view of time. While Holiday provides more support for his stance of the disc being based on observable phenomenon, I feel he's made his point, and we'll take a shortcut to another facet of his overall theory. He feels that the discs are hiding themselves because they fear the consequences of a closer relationship. You see, they've been talking to our exes, and they're kind of freaked out by how aggressive we are. Holiday cites historical evidence of spears being offered as signs of devotion to the discs, as well as clay axes. And in other places, such as Israel and Västergötland, the axes being offered were broken, because we're going to be different this time. And that leads us into discussion question number 6. And so you've actually got two options. We could either, again, talk about overall our overall thoughts on Holiday's argument and how well we feel it lines up with our other research, or if we have any thoughts on the idea of UFOs being rescue missions for the unquiet dead, I'd love to hear them.
I mean, I just like that idea. I think it's fun, especially considering we've come across stories we've talked about on the show, not just of people seeing the dead during a UFO experience. But there, we've also read a couple stories where during the, it was actually one of Streber's stories. During a particular abduction experience, he was there when a UFO was helping souls on board. And I don't know, maybe there is something to that, that like really they are afterlife admins of a kind. Like maybe 90% of people do make the transition just fine. But those that don't, they need someone to come down, explain what's happening to them, and then help them get up there. The people who run away from the light, as it were. And some of them manage to stay away. They stay in hiding. That's where we get our lingering hauntings. And maybe the rest get to go up in the silver ship and go to the afterlife. I don't have evidence. I just think it's neat.
We don't have evidence of any of this, but thinking about that, something that I've been, I guess, thinking about just a lot in general when it comes to these kind of topics is the idea or thinking about the fact that, like, a lot of these stories of mythology, right, are just that, right? They're stories, including the Bible. The Bible is stories. It's, yep. Many of it is, you know, stories or letters or whatever, but the vast majority of it is stories meant to teach lessons. It's not necessarily a fact. It's not necessarily a historical text.
It's meant to be read like most spiritual and magical texts, metaphorically.
Right. So now, the reason why I bring that up is because what if you're right? Like, we're talking about UFOs being an escort for the souls of the dead. It wouldn't be that hard to then say, okay, well, maybe that's just what they were describing when they're talking about the boatman.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
When they're talking about how Menonon MacLear escorts souls to the other side on his ship. Maybe that's what, you know, they're talking, because that's another common theme you see amongst a lot of theology is somebody escorting souls of the dead to their final resting place.
Usually on some sort of craft as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I believe I don't remember the details at all, but I remember isn't that also an element in Egyptian mythology? That there is a ship that takes you there?
Yes. The pharaohs, the tombs of pretty much every pharaoh, particularly when, this is just, by the way, a fun aside, the smaller tombs, were later, largely because, as far as we can tell, they started to realize that pyramid building was impractical. It was killing workers and wasting resources and taking up a shit ton of space. But back when pyramids were the default for pharaohs, and in a lot of the tombs for non-pharaoh members of society that could afford full mummifications and tombs, there is a ship, a beautifully constructed ship that is just in one of the burial chambers, because it was believed that was the ship that the person in that tomb would pack all of their stuff in and would essentially sail down the river to be able to, you know, that was the boat that they took for every stop on their journey. Like, every stop of the journey was supposed to be this place along this mystical river as they were on their way to the reeds, to the actual underworld. And yeah, all of their stuff was supposed to go in that boat.
So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, even in Passport to Magonia, they talk about how they used to see the crafts in the sky, not always as saucers, but as actual ships.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So I don't know. I think that's an interesting idea. Not so much as always a rescue bit, but just as maybe that is part of their purpose.
Which, you know, goes back to something I don't remember if we talked about this episode or last episode, the whole idea that the UFOs come from the same place that we call the afterlife or the spirit world, the DMT realm, all those things. I mean, There is, I think, a very, and I know there's a book by, two books by Joshua Cutchin about this that I really want to get to, but there does seem to be, amongst all of the various manifestations of the capital P phenomenon, an undercurrent surrounding death and dying. And that seems to come up again and again and again. I got to think there's something there.
Oh, yeah.
I really do. If again, I, you know, entertain everything, believe nothing, so I don't really have a core philosophy or religious belief about the ultimate nature of things. But I do think that there's, if any of this is real and it's all connected somehow, then I do think that connection is probably death. And that, granted, I do have to admit, you know, again, harkening back to another conversation we had today, that does come from, likely is influenced by my own bias, because questions about my own mortality and what comes next is something that's very near to me. As someone who got close, I near very, very nearly died. And that affected me very deeply. Mm-hmm. And it's never left me, that fact. And so I think about it all the time. And yeah, I do wonder if at the end of the day, like, the reason we can't know, the reason it has to be so mysterious, the reason that, you know, all of the evidence goes missing is because ultimately all those roads lead to one place, and it's where we're headed.
Yeah.
That, like, you can't know what's on the journey ahead of you, otherwise you'll stop changing now when you need to be.
Yeah.
Because if I know, let's say if I know at the end of my life paradise is there, what's my motivation to stick around and continue to grow?
I mean, it's a good point, and it's just like the idea that if people found out that heaven was real and it didn't matter, like your actions here didn't matter, but once you died, you were there, people would just kill themselves.
Yep, there'd be mass suicides. And I mean, and here's the thing: is in that scenario, the fucked up thing is then you have to ask the question: yeah, there'd be mass suicides, but those people aren't wrong. That's a perfectly sane response
yeah.
to that information being proven true somehow.
Absolutely. It would be, just because it's like, why would I stand if it didn't matter? If my actions here didn't matter, why would I continue to suffer? Because let's be real, every day is a struggle, right? In modern day society, the way that it is, every day is a struggle. Why would I continue to struggle if I didn't have to?
Right. And I mean,
which I don't believe, for the record.
Well, and that's the thing, is like, I would never advocate somebody, I never advocate for mass suicides. I can't say I never advocate for suicide, because I am a firm believer in physician assisted death. If you're going to die anyway, I don't see a reason why that shouldn't be a thing.
Correct. Why would we torture you?
Yeah. Yeah. We have more kindness for our animals than we do for each other.
Yep. Sometimes.
But yeah.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, in terms of the medical options we provide. That said, I couldn't even blame those people for coming to that decision.
Yeah.
I don't think that decision would be for me, because I tend to think that I'm here, and maybe, yeah, what if it doesn't matter? My actions don't determine where I go. Those actions still determine how I change, who I am, and that is
correct.
Important to me.
Yeah, no, same.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's an interesting idea, and I do like the correlation, the common theme that if you don't go to the afterlife on your own, or maybe if you do, there is a craft involved. There's some sort of shit, which actually, if you wanted to take it ideal, you know, kind of a idealist spiritual direction, it could easily be that, yeah, because you are going to the afterlife, in your human mind, though, going places requires more than simply I'm here, now I'm there. There has to be a journey, and so you create the construct of the vehicle and the process of going, and before you can let yourself be there. Especially if you go with the whole idea of consciousness is everything, so we are everywhere and everything. There's no going anywhere, but there is kind of fooling ourselves to think we are going somewhere. And maybe that's the purpose these vehicles serve.
I think Vikings also believed that a boat was there to take you to the afterlife, because that's why their warriors got burned in their ships.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's an incredibly common motif.
Oh, yeah.
It just, it's, I mean, now granted, you could also make the argument that it rises, you know, that old argument that Jay, you were talking about earlier, the whole that a lot of these common motifs are common because of shared human psychology. I will, you know, basically just another way of rephrasing the argument I just made. If all of humans think of dying as going somewhere else, then it makes sense that they would give a vessel or a craft because that's how you go.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But that said, I mean, it's interesting. I do. Yeah, I heavily suspect that the UFO truth, the Loch Ness truth, the Sasquatch truth, all runs, if not to the same place, they all run down the same highway.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think there's way too one. I think there's way too much crossover for there not to be something that is, you know, the connective tissue between it all. But I think that there's more to it even than that. I think that there is a piece of this puzzle that is in and around either death, the afterlife, whatever it might be, that is all encompassing with all of the things that we talk about on this show.
All the cryptids and aliens. That's just what our souls actually look like.
Maybe.
Entirely possible. Or, you know, they're just the residents of the other world, and sometimes they're here too. Because
yeah,
sometimes we're there too. And maybe, I don't know, maybe when they die, they come here. I don't know.
Turns out that, like, we're considered, like, in the giant spiritual cosmology, we're like, God, the fucking toddler humans. I have to go take care of them again. They're always getting up to something. Look at this one. Paul keeps sticking his dick in a light socket. Don't know why.
I mean, it could be that cryptids are just, you know, angels or in the hierarchy of, like, you know, heavenly beings and things like that, or in the hierarchy of the
cosmic
opposite
beings.
Yeah, the cosmic beings. Like, I could see that. That's actually kind of interesting.
Well, and you take it, if you want to say they, you know, they, then you have to go into, well, do they each serve an individual purpose as dictated by their form? Like, is Loch Ness a water elemental or a angel of the water, whereas Bigfoot is a forest spirit or a spirit forest god or an angel of the wilderness?
I mean, ultimately, I actually like that. You know, angels are of the air, Loch Ness is of the water, Bigfoot is of the earth.
Ah, and everything was fine until the dragons attacked.
That's correct. They are of fire.
So are the Fae.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Our Fae, as in like British Isles, Western European Fae, not really. The Djinn, which have a lot of parallels to the Fae, but are not really considered the same thing by most people. Djinn are of fire. That is the distinction.
Yeah, smokeless flame, right?
Yeah. That's the distinction between them and humans in Islamic thought, is humans were crafted by Allah out of the earth, and the Djinn are the people crafted of fire.
You know, it's interesting. The Tooth of Dedannan, who are Fae, right?
Mm-hmm.
They arrived here via boat.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe the sky ships that we read about in Passport to Magonia, that's just the antiquated way of viewing the passage.
Yeah.
Now that we live in an age of higher technology, that seems too pedestrian. People no longer want to conceptualize such a transcendent moment through a three-mast ship. There's other ways of going now, and so the way that we manifest, the way that we visualize, has updated accordingly.
There's also the train of the dead trope,
mm-hmm,
in like American ghost folklore.
That's actually a really good point.
Yeah, there's that constant reoccurring idea of like, I got on a train that was running really late after I thought all the trains had stopped running for the night, and I slowly realized that I'd actually gotten onto a train filled with dead people, and I needed to get off very quickly at the next stop because it was going somewhere I wasn't supposed to. That's become a cliche at this point.
Okay, hear me out. This is kind of a tangent, but that you made me think of something. You know the Tenney Diner story?
Yeah.
What if that's not a time, like he didn't walk into like a time, whatever, like someplace it was in a different universe,
a time
or
warp,
whatever. Yeah. What if that was a stop along the path to the other side? That was just a diner that happens to be there along the path to get from this world to the other.
A place to grab a bite on your way to your stop?
Yeah.
And then we go into, okay, so building on the whole idea that everything is consciousness, what is the afterlife? What if, yeah, so we often enough, people who say, well, everything is conscious, the afterlife is you become part of that whole again. But what if that's not the case? What if that's what happens? What if what happens is more in line with what you kind of believed going in, but not just that. What if the progress of growing doesn't end when you die? There's levels. So I die, if I really believe in a Christian heaven, I'll go there, and I think I'm there for eternity, but I'm not. It's just the stop I'm at. And at some point, I will grow to the point that I get back on the train and go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And there's always more else to go to. And honestly, that appeals to me greatly.
Yeah.
Because I love the idea of being on a never-ending journey that literally never stops.
That is a common thread throughout many branches and schools of Buddhism, is the idea of there being multiple different afterlives, and those afterlives are different levels of reality, that there are different meditation heavens and different realms of torment that in English translations are often referred to as hell. I can't speak to the accuracy of that label, but basically, yeah, this idea that there are multiple different places you go to in between your incarnations on Earth, and being incarnated on Earth is just one version of a life you can live in the cycle, because, you know, for Buddhists and Hindus, the true afterlife is exiting the cycle, is exiting all of those realms to whatever nothingness or unity exists beyond it.
Yeah, it also makes me think, okay, so, but in that framework, these afterlife realms, let's say you die and you go to heaven. I mean, if you're recognizing it as heaven, very clearly it matches what you had in your mind about it and what culturally exists for the idea of heaven. And that, and it would make sense if everything is consciousness, because basically those are subdivisions carved out by human thought. Right? In that mindset, what's the difference between a heaven that was created through human thought and a fictional world that was created through human thought? What if some of the stops that you could go spend the afterlife on, and this is entirely powder fantasy, but what if it's like, next stop heaven, after that the Field of Reeds, and after that, Middle Earth? Like, and, yeah. And people can go and exist in these places, because ultimately they're just thought palaces. They're things that were created through human thought and attention. And yeah, maybe the official afterlives are much more ornate and built up and detailed because, say, you know, there's been thousands and thousands of years for them to kind of harden into what they are. But at the same time, you can't tell me if that can happen, that wouldn't happen for something like Middle Earth, when you not only have the books, you then have decades of people talking about it, obsessing about it, writing reams of fan fiction.
Mm-hmm. Of course you like the idea of Westworld afterlife.
Well, I like the idea that we contain worlds. That just because we're going somewhere doesn't actually mean we're going anywhere. That we're still within this realm of mentation, where the human imagination is ultimately the true, not even human imagination, the conscious imagination is ultimately the true limits on reality.
Yeah. Oh, I like it too.
There are also, I encountered these online when I was first exploring the idea of neo-paganism and Wicca and stuff like that. There were neo-pagan groups I encountered that essentially used the Lord of the Rings books and their associated, like, additional, like, other books by Tolkien to form part of the basis of their theology. There was this one coven where when you joined it, you were expected to take a craft name in Elvish, because Tolkien was the primary influence on their theology and their philosophy. And that's not the only piece. Like, okay, that movie The Craft from the 90s, the people making that movie were trying very hard to not offend actual Wiccan and pagan groups. Like, they were trying to be culturally sensitive, and they brought in religious academics, like theological academics, and actual members of those groups, like actual community leaders, and said, is there like a safe god for us to be having these girls worshiping in their coven? Is there like a god that your communities universally agree is evil where we're not going to upset anyone, or what should we do? And the recommendation they got across the board was, you'd be better off kind of just inventing a new god out of whole cloth and making up lore and theology behind him. And they went, great, fantastic. We will do that. And within a few years of that movie coming out, there are to this day Wiccan-adjacent covens and related traditions that worship that god as if it is a true deity. Mm. That has become a god now.
I would say so. It's a god now.
Yeah. Yep. Well, I mean, and there's... And I, this is really tricky theological grounds to stand on, but if that is true, so the belief makes the god, what's the difference between, say, that entity and Ash Ketchum Pokemon Trainer?
I mean, that was part of my capstone project in my undergrad, is that I wish I could go back and redo that project more as like a proper adult, because there were dots there that I was trying to connect where I didn't do a good enough job on it. But that's kind of what I was trying to drive at a few points is in modern day America, the relationship that nerds have to members of the DC and Marvel kind of superhero pantheons, it is not different from having folk gods. Like Gail Simone talks about this in a foreword she wrote to one of the Wonder Woman encyclopedias, of she's had people come up to her at conventions and say that their relationship to the character of Wonder Woman has given them the strength to get through another round of chemotherapy, to leave a domestic violence situation, to overcome suicidality and other mental illnesses. And it's like, how is this not a goddess at this point? Like an actual legitimate, I have her symbol tattooed into my fucking flesh. It was the first tattoo I ever got. Like, how is this not devotion?
Right.
As far as many people would be concerned, there is no difference.
Well, like I have in my house, in my office, on top of one of my bookshelves, I have a number of items put aside from the Dark Tower universe by Stephen King. A couple Funkos, an action figure, some books, a cool box with some art on it. And I have that up there, and it's definitely up there as a display, right? If I were to build an altar to the gunslinger, it wouldn't look that different.
No.
People have been at, humans are innately devotional. We do this, it's just a part of habit. And I think that's where fandom comes from, ultimately.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, it's even now, like right now, the three of us have been obsessing about a new show that just came out.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just having conversations about before this and theorizing and thinking about it. And I can't help but think that mental energy of the three of us, it's a good conversation. That's all it is. You multiply that by millions.
Mm-hmm.
Who's to say that's not now a mentation realm, a place that exists as a distinct mode of thought that then later you can go to? And I think it's just a different way of looking at like the Philip K. Dick idea that these stories we're channeling from the universe. It just flips the equation. Stories are what we give the universe.
Yeah.
Stories are us diversifying the universe and by extension, diversifying our own ability and what we can experience.
Ultimately, this comes, you know, a lot of this goes back to what I was saying, you know, towards the start of this question. Everything broken down in mythology is just stories that we as a society have eventually put up on the pedestal as these creatures, these people, these things being gods. Many of the deities that we talk about in Celtic mythology as gods now were not gods during their time. They were merely warriors or merely a king, but now they are gods. You know, Merlin in Arthurian lore wasn't anything more than a crazy wild man, wasn't even in the original Arthurian lore, but that's beside the point. But now there are people who have dedicated altars to Merlin. There are people who have dedicated their magical practices to Merlin, a French insertion to a to an English story.
Yeah, and here's the thing is that I wouldn't say that that is spiritually incorrect.
No.
Like, it invites, of course, some examples which seem on surface to be insane. But if you really adopt this, then they're not. Like, I wouldn't, if this was really how it was, I couldn't blame someone if they built an altar to Batman. Even though we know who made Batman.
It doesn't matter anymore.
It doesn't matter because the individual, you know, it goes back to death of the artist. The world, the mythos, the character is larger than the artist the moment anyone else starts putting thought into it. It becomes an amalgam. If you say, you take Batman today, the Batman that exists today is not the creation of the guy who invented Batman. He is the amalgam of every thought and action and idea that's been put into Batman since.
The only caveat that I'll put on that, I guess, with in regards to death of the author, is that the author actually has to be dead.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
And there has to be a cultural impact to get to the point where we're talking to what we're talking about, like death, not in, I guess, true death of the artist, like looking at it from a like scholarly perspective, but in the context that we're talking about.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Then I would say one, the actual artist has to be dead, and two, there has to be a massive cultural impact to the level of something like Batman. Because if we were having this conversation about Harry Potter, it would be a different conversation entirely.
Right.
But they both had massive cultural impact. But one of them, Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling is still alive, still a bigot, and is a bigot and pushing her bigotry on the world. So you can't separate the art from the artist in that instance.
Well, and yeah. I would say that if we want to look at that situation under this theoretical, metaphysical framework, then in that situation is, yes, other people are adding to the DNA of what is that the thought idea of Harry Potter and the Harry Potter universe, right? However, she is still there adding to it. Like, and so it's really what you need is for that author to die and then enough others to come in that the original author's intention, the DNA they contributed, is so diluted to a point, yes, that it's become something more than just their idea.
Yeah, either the artist has to George Lucas this shit and just walk away, or they gotta be dead, and then, like you said, and that I wholeheartedly agree with. If J.K. Rowling died, other people took the intellectual property, started writing their own shit, and they diluted out all of her bigotry out of Harry Potter, fuck yeah, let's go. Like, that's literally all I want in life.
So, but, I mean, it also could mean that, and if this is true, it means that Troy, Rory, when you die, you might just get your Hogwarts letter finally.
You know, I think at this point, I don't think that's where I'd go.
Yeah.
I think I at this point, right now, I think I'd end up in Roshar.
See, here's, oh, that's a good answer. I mean, terrible place to live.
But, oh, it'd be terrible. Yeah.
I mean, here's the thing is that I really do like the idea, and this is just my personal preference. I really like the idea of, like, because I've gone to many paranormal conferences and fairs and stuff like that, and I usually make a point of trying to visit at least one psychic because it's fun and I support them and I treat it as entertainment. But that said, a couple times it has become something more than entertainment because they were really on the money. That said, I've had multiple ones tell me that I have just been around for a long time and I just keep coming back. And I love the idea of me as a perpetual tourist. So I never land in one afterlife. I just keep going between them.
I honestly, like, I feel like that would be me too. Like, especially because I have ADHD, I'd just be like, all right, I've beaten this one to death. Let's move on to the next one.
Let's move on to the next one. Shoot myself in the forehead and that gets me back on the train.
Yeah.
All right, Jay, are you ready to go back to Earth? Send me to Old Valyria again. You can't be a dragon lord forever. You send me to Old Valyria or I will make such a scene.
Actually, what if that's it? So we are here on this world because we need to learn something this world can teach us, right? What if, yeah, we do jump around. We don't dictate the lesson plan, though. And that if you knew that if you die, you go to the next lesson plan, they can't let you cheat and skip.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's a good point. That's because you know that we cheat.
Oh, fuck yeah, I cheat. Are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah.
I don't. What are you saying? The next level is dragon riding. I'm sorry. Where's a gun? I only need one bullet. I'll rent the gun. I'm sorry. Two bullets. I'm not. I'm taking my wife. Oh, this got dark.
Let's move on.
Yeah.
Are we about ready to wrap up this episode?
God, I hope so, because I don't even know where we are right now.
We have spiraled so far off topic that I don't know where to begin other than to say it's time for the About the Author.
Okay, the About the Author. Frederick Ted William Holliday was born in 1921 in Stockport, Cheshire, England. He was an English journalist who wrote books on angling, the Loch Ness Monster, and the paranormal. He first grew interested in the topic of the Loch Ness Monster after the High Gray photograph was published in 1933. From 1939 to 1946, he served in the Royal Air Force, and in August 1962, he made his first trip to Loch Ness, and in 1963 joined the Loch Ness Phenomena Investigation Bureau. During his life, he wrote a number of books, including but not limited to Sea Trout, How to Catch Them, in 1956, River Fishing for Sea Trout, in 1960, Fishing in Wales, in 1964, and at least four other fishing books I'm not going to list here. In 1968, he published his first book on the anomalous with The Great Orm of Loch Ness, A Practical Inquiry into the Nature and Habits of the Water Monster. This was followed by The Dragons in the Disc in 1973, which was later published under the title we covered today. In 1979, he published a UFO book, The Dyfed Enigma, Unidentified Flying Objects in West Wales, with Randall Jones Pugh. And in 1986, he posthumously published The Goblin Universe with Colin Wilson, which contains his final thoughts on the anomalous, which continues the trend of leaving behind strict materialism and embracing a more nuanced, idealist-based interpretation of the phenomenon. And he died in 1979 in Haverford West, Pembrokeshire, Wales. And that's what we got.
Wow. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot more weird details that just didn't make it in because I didn't want to go on a diatribe about his fishing accomplishments.
No, valid. I'm glad you didn't. Because I would just fall asleep because fishing is boring.
Yeah, I don't like fishing.
Not a fan.
It's boredom followed by having to kill a living thing, and I don't like either of those things.
Yep, agreed. I'm not a fan. Well, anyway, are we ready for housekeeping?
Housekeeping?
All right. So if you liked what you heard, then you can go ahead and like and subscribe on whatever podcasting platform it is that you are listening to us on. And if it's Apple or Spotify, you can leave us a review. 5 stars preferred, but not required.
Oh, we're done begging now.
It was just a one episode thing.
Okay. You're just desperate the once.
Yeah, just the once.
Okay.
At least for now. We'll see.
Yeah.
I can't tell you what next the next book will bring, especially because I'm leading it. But if you want to reach out to us, you can do that at noctivianpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can reach out to us on social media, on Twitter, @NoctivigantPod, or I'm @MixRoryWicks.
I am @BearishTerror.
I'm @MidwestUndead.
And we also have some other social medias, like an Instagram, Noctivigant_podcast.
We have a Reddit account, NoctivigantPodcast.
We have a Tumblr account, NoctivigantPodcast.
And we have a Discord. All these links and more will be in the description. And I think that's about it. So, next month, as mentioned previously, we're going to be reading Adam Berry's book, Goodbye, Hello. And, this, I guess, a special announcement. We'll be having some guests for that month. We are joining us for the episodes, at least, and likely the live stream, but joining us for the episodes of Adam Berry's Hello, Goodbye is going to be the hosts of the Quite Unusual podcast.
Yeah, we met them at Paracon. They're cool. We're cool. So we decided to do something together.
Yeah, cool people, cool weirdos meeting up, hanging out, going to talk about weird stuff. And I think that's it. Anything else? Any final thoughts on this book?
Dragons.
I liked it. I finished reading it in November. So I'm glad that I can finally move it into the archive of my brain and stop thinking about giant water horses. Because especially now, after these episodes, they have a completely different connotation that's deeply upsetting to me, involving the stuff that's dredged from the bottom of Loch Ness. And I'll leave it there.
All right, Jay. Lead us out of here.
Please.
Good night, ghosties. Good night, ghoulies. Good night, moth people. Stay safe out there in those midnight roads. And I strongly advise against night diving.
Yeah, don't get lost.
Yeah, you know what's down there in the water.
Follow the signposts.
Follow the signposts, unless there's one that appears to have been hung by Elish hands. I'm just saying, the Loch Ness Monster doesn't have to hang around for photos or to be seen by anyone with a fancy PhD or someone who can get on C-SPAN with a 5-minute phone call. I just want it to hang around the surface long enough for me to pet it. Not even a lot, just a little petting. And then it can go back into the peat or into the sea or wherever it hangs out. I just want to pet the dragon.